A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
I was watching a Matt Damon interview the other night, the one where he's talking about raising his daughters, and he just seemed so settled, like a guy who happened to become a movie star, but somehow skipped the part where it makes you strange. And it got me thinking about what Daniel wrote in. He's been turning over the question of who actually goes into professional acting. Not the Matt Damons of the world, but the thousands of people who spend years, sometimes decades, auditioning for roles they'll never get, working day jobs they don't want, all for a career where the odds of making a living wage are, frankly, terrible. And he's asking whether anyone has actually sat down with professional actors and asked them what motivated that kind of tenacity. Because here's the strange thing about acting as a career. If you succeed, you become famous. Very few jobs have that baked into the equation. And Daniel's point is that this fame element distorts how the public sees the whole profession. We assume actors are chasing celebrity, while the rest of us are motivated by lifestyle or salary or whatever. But what if fame isn't the main driver for most of them? What are the other motivators? And what does the history of acting tell us about why a select few are drawn to this life?
I love this question because it's got layers. There's the economic layer, which is brutal. There's the psychological layer, which is where it gets interesting. And there's the historical layer, which is where most people's assumptions fall apart completely.
So, where do we start?
Let's start with the economics, because that's the part that makes the whole thing seem insane from the outside. The Screen Actors Guild, SAG-AFTRA, has about 160,000 members. Most of them earn less than $26,000 a year from acting. Not from their total income, just from acting work. And here's the kicker. A 2019 study found that only 14% of SAG-AFTRA members qualify for union health insurance through acting earnings alone. 14%. That means 86% of the people in the actors' union can't clear the earnings threshold to get health coverage from the thing they're supposedly doing for a living.
So the union is mostly a club for people who don't actually make a living at the thing the union exists to represent.
And that $26,000 figure, that's not a starting salary, that's the median. Half of all union actors make less than that from acting. These are people who've cleared the bar to get into the union in the first place, which means they've already booked some professional work. You have to earn your way into SAG-AFTRA. So we're not even talking about the aspirants who've never booked anything. We're talking about the people who've made it past the first few gates, and most of them still can't pay rent from acting.
And yet they keep going. That's the part Daniel's really asking about. The tenacity. The showing up to audition after audition when the rejection rate is above 95%, even at mid-career levels. That's not normal human behavior. Most people, if you gave them a task where they failed 95 times out of 100, they'd quit within a month.
There's a researcher named Angela Duckworth who's done a lot of work on grit, this combination of passion and persistence for long-term goals. Her work was mostly in education, but the framework applies here beautifully. Grit predicts who stays in West Point, who makes it through Navy SEAL training, who survives, Teach for America. And acting might be one of the purest tests of grit that exists, because the feedback loop is so punishing. You audition, you don't get it, and most of the time you never find out why. There's no performance review, no one tells you what to improve, you just don't get the call. And you have to go to the next one anyway, and the next one for years, with no signal that you're getting closer.
That's the thing that would break most people, I think. Not the rejection itself, but the silence. The absence of any information about whether you're making progress.
And yet actors do it. Which brings us to the question Daniel asked. Has anyone actually asked them why? And the answer is yes, and the results aren't what most people would expect. In 2021, researchers from the University of Kent and the University of Birmingham survey professional actors about their motivations. Not drama students, not aspirants, but people who were actually working in the profession. And what they found was that intrinsic motivators ranked far above fame and wealth. creative expression, collaboration, the thrill of live performance, a sense of calling. Those were the things that kept people in it. Fame and money were way down the list.
That's actually surprising to me. I'd have assumed that after a decade of struggling, the people who stuck around would be the ones who were most desperate for the external validation. The fame seekers would be the ones with the tenacity, because they want it so badly.
That's the intuitive assumption, and it's wrong. The people who persist are the ones who find the work itself rewarding. The fame seekers wash out because fame is a terrible motivator. It's too distant, too abstract, and the odds are too bad. If you're only in it for the celebrity, you'll quit when you realize that celebrity is a lottery ticket, not a career path. But if you love the craft, the rehearsal process, the moment of performance, the collaboration with other actors and directors, then the daily experience of the work is its own reward, even when the big break never comes.
So the tenacity is almost a byproduct of the intrinsic motivation. You don't persist because you're gritty. You persist because you love the thing, and the grit is what it looks like from the outside.
That's a really clean way to put it, and it matches what the qualitative research shows. Actors describe it as a calling. They use language like, I had to do this, or I couldn't imagine doing anything else. And that's not unique to acting. You see the same phenomenon in medicine, in the clergy, in teaching. There's a whole literature on vocational calling, this sense that a particular kind of work is what you were put on earth to do. And it's a powerful predictor of persistence in fields with high burnout and high barriers to entry.
The difference being that a doctor who feels called to medicine still gets a paycheck. The calling doesn't have to sustain them through poverty.
Right, and that's what makes acting such an extreme case. The calling has to be strong enough to justify years of financial precarity. Most actors have day jobs. They wait tables, they temp, they drive for rideshare apps. And they do that not because they're failed actors, but because that's what being a working actor looks like. The day job subsidizes the calling.
So here's the paradox Daniel's pointing at. Acting is a career where success is defined by fame. The public sees the Matt Damons and the Margot Robbies, the tiny fraction who made it, and assumes that fame was the goal all along. But the research says most actors are motivated by the craft, the collaboration, the sense of calling. The fame is a byproduct they tolerate, not a goal they pursue. And the public's assumption that actors are fame-seeking might actually be a projection. We see the visible few and assume their motivations apply to the invisible many.
And the fame lens distorts everything downstream. It shapes casting because producers are looking for people who can become famous, not people who are good. It shapes public perception because we assume every actor is a narcissist chasing validation. It shapes policy because arts funding gets framed as subsidizing celebrity dreams rather than supporting a legitimate profession. None of that's accurate, but it's all downstream of the fame-success conflation.
So we've got the economics and the research on motivation. But Daniel also asked about the history. How did acting become this fame-driven industry in the first place?
That's where it gets really interesting, because for most of history, acting wasn't a glamorous profession at all. In 18th century England, actors were often legally classified as vagabonds. The Vagrancy Act of 1744, I think it was, lumped them in with beggars and petty criminals. You could be arrested for being an actor. The profession was disreputable, low status, morally suspect. Women actors were assumed to be prostitutes. The theater itself was seen as a den of vice.
So the idea that acting is a glamorous, desirable career is a relatively recent invention.
Very recent. And it happened in stages. The 19th century saw the rise of the actor-manager, people like Henry Irving and Ellen Terry, who elevated the craft and made it respectable. The early 20th century saw the birth of cinema, which created a new kind of fame. But the real shift was the studio system in the 1920s through the 1950s. That's when actors stopped being working artists and became celebrities. The studios manufactured fame as a business strategy. They controlled the image, the publicity, the fan magazines. They turned actors into products.
So the fame element wasn't something that was inherent to acting. It was something that was bolted on by an industry that needed to sell tickets.
And television accelerated it. Suddenly, you had actors in people's living rooms every week, and the parasocial relationships got more intense. The fame became the product, not the acting. And that's the historical accident that created the modern conflation. We assume acting success equals fame because for the last 100 years, the industry has been structured to make it look that way.
Which brings us back to Matt Damon, the guy who seems well-adjusted despite being one of the most famous actors on the planet. Daniel's observation was that he seems like a normal person, and I think the research on intrinsic motivation explains why. If you got into acting because you love the craft, and you happen to become famous, the fame doesn't have to warp you. You didn't need it. It's a side effect.
There's actually research on this. Intrinsic motivation seems to buffer against the psychological toll of fame. People who are driven by external validation, by fame and wealth, tend to struggle more when they achieve it, because the external rewards never feel like enough. But people who are driven by the work itself, they can enjoy the fame as a bonus without needing it to feel whole. Matt Damon has talked about this in interviews. He said that he got into acting because he loved it, not because he wanted to be famous, and that's probably why he seems so grounded.
It's almost like the fame seekers are setting themselves up for misery, because even if they succeed, they've won a prize that can't satisfy them. While the craft-driven actors, the ones who would have been happy doing regional theater forever, they're the ones who can actually handle the fame when it comes.
And that's the second-order insight, I think. The fame lens doesn't just distort public perception, it distorts the profession itself. It attracts the wrong people for the wrong reasons, and it repels people who might be wonderful actors but don't want anything to do with celebrity culture. The industry would probably be healthier if fame weren't so central to it.
What does this say about career choice in general? Daniel's question was about acting, but there's a broader point here. In any field with extreme outcome inequality, where a tiny fraction of people capture most of the rewards, what keeps the rest going?
The same thing, I suspect. Intrinsic motivation. The people who persist in music, in writing, in academic research, in startups, they're not all chasing the jackpot. Some of them are, sure, but the ones who last are the ones who love the work itself. The jackpot chasers burn out when the jackpot doesn't arrive. The craft lovers keep going because the work is the point.
So the acting case is a window into something bigger. It's a natural experiment in what happens when you take a craft and attach a lottery to it, and the answer seems to be that the lottery doesn't actually motivate the people who do the best work. It just distorts how everyone else sees them.
It distorts how they see themselves, potentially. If you're a working actor making $40,000 a year doing voice work in regional theater, and the culture tells you that you're not a real actor because you're not famous, that's got to take a toll. Even if you love the work, the fame lens makes you feel like a failure.
That's the cruel part. The fame lens doesn't just misread the motivations of the successful. It invalidates the careers of everyone else. The character actors, the voice actors, the people doing children's theater in small towns. They're all actors. They're doing the work, but the fame lens says they don't count.
That's historically backwards. For most of the history of theater, the person doing children's theater in a small town was the norm. The celebrity actor is the anomaly. We've just been living in the anomaly for so long that we've forgotten it's an anomaly.
Let's zoom out. Daniel asked about the history of acting and why a select few are drawn to pursue it. And I think the history shows that the draw was always there, but it wasn't always about fame. It was about the thing itself. The transformation, the storytelling, the communal experience of live performance. The fame is a 20th century addition.
The select few are the people who feel that draw so strongly that they're willing to tolerate the economic precarity, the rejection, the instability. They're not chasing fame, they're answering a call. And the call is loud enough to drown out the part of their brain that says this is a terrible financial decision.
Which is why the tenacity looks insane from the outside, but feels inevitable from the inside. You don't persist in the face of 95% rejection rates because you're disciplined. You persist because you can't not do it.
There's a phrase that keeps coming up in the research on vocational calling: I didn't choose this, it chose me. And I think that's the piece the fame lens misses. The public sees actors as people who chose fame. But the actors themselves, the ones who last, describe it as something they had no choice about.
That's a profound distinction. Choosing fame is a rational, if misguided, calculation. Being chosen by the work is something else entirely. It's not a decision, it's a compulsion.
That compulsion predates the fame era by centuries. The actors who were classified as vagabonds in 18th century England weren't doing it for the money or the status. There was no money or status. They were doing it because they had to. The fame era just made the compulsion look like ambition.
The history actually reinforces the psychology. The intrinsic motivation was always there. The fame was always an overlay. And the modern confusion is just a failure to distinguish between the two.
Which brings me to a question for you, Korn. Do you think the fame lens is permanent? Or is it possible that we're already moving past it? With streaming fragmenting the audience, with social media creating microfame, with the old studio system dead and gone, is the era of the mega celebrity actor ending?
I think the mega celebrity actor is becoming a smaller category. There are still movie stars, but they don't have the cultural dominance they had in the 50s or the 90s. The audience is too fragmented. Everyone's famous to someone and unknown to everyone else. And that might actually be healthy for the profession. If fame stops being the defining feature of success, maybe the craft can reassert itself.
That's an optimistic take, and it matches what the research would predict. If intrinsic motivation is what sustains actors, then a world with less fame pressure might be a world with more sustainable acting careers. Not necessarily more lucrative ones, but more sustainable ones.
The economics are still brutal, though. Even if the fame lens fades, the fundamental problem remains. Too many people want to do this, and there's not enough paid work to go around. The intrinsic motivation doesn't pay the rent.
No, it doesn't. And that's the tension at the heart of Daniel's question. The calling is real, the tenacity is real, the love of the craft is real, and none of it changes the fact that most actors will never make a living from acting. The intrinsic motivation explains why they persist. It doesn't justify the system that exploits that persistence.
Exploits is a strong word, but I take your point. The industry depends on a vast pool of talented, motivated people who will work for almost nothing because they love the work. If they all quit tomorrow, the whole system would collapse. So the intrinsic motivation isn't just a personal trait. It's an industry subsidy.
That's a dark way to put it, but it's accurate. The passion is the subsidy. The love of the craft is what keeps the pipeline full of people willing to audition for free, rehearse for free, work for scale. The industry doesn't have to pay for development because the actors develop themselves, at their own expense, for years before they ever book a paying role.
The fame lens helps maintain that subsidy. It keeps the dream alive. If you believe that fame is the goal and fame is achievable, you'll keep showing up. The industry has an interest in maintaining the fame myth because it's what keeps the talent pool stocked.
That's a properly cynical analysis, and I think there's truth to it. But I don't want to lose sight of the other side. The actors aren't just being exploited. They're also doing something they love. The fact that the system benefits from their passion doesn't negate the passion. It just complicates it.
Fair. The passion is real, and the exploitation is real, and they coexist. That's probably the most honest thing we can say about the economics of acting.
I did a day as a featured extra on a legal drama back in the early 2000s. Courtroom scene. I sat in the same spot for 14 hours and they paid me $150. The craft services table had these little sandwiches, turkey, and brie. I ate 11 of them.
14 hours for $150. That's below minimum wage in most states.
They didn't pay overtime. Said it was a flat day rate. I didn't argue. The sandwiches were good. But the thing is, I got talking to the other background actors and most of them were there for exactly that. $150 and free food. It was a gig, like unloading a truck or temping in an office. They didn't care about the craft, they cared about the check clearing.
The background world is a completely different economy from the speaking roles.
Completely. The people with speaking roles, they were a different breed. There was one guy, had maybe 6 lines, and he spent the whole day in the corner running them under his breath. Not because he was nervous, because he was working. He talked about the scene like it was a religion. The motivation, the subtext, what the character wanted. He was making scale, which was maybe $700 for the day, and he treated it like he was doing Shakespeare at the National.
That matches the research. The intrinsic motivation shows up even at the smallest scales, 6 lines, and he's treating it like a calling.
I still have the call sheet from that day, framed it. It's in my hallway, it's got my name on it, misspelled, but it's there. And the lead actor, the famous one, I won't name him, he was the most miserable person I've ever met on a set. Sat in his trailer all day, only came out for takes, didn't talk to anyone, looked like he'd rather be anywhere else.
The guy with six lines is having a transcendent artistic experience, and the famous lead is miserable. That's the whole episode in one anecdote.
The fame didn't make him happy. That's the thing. He had the thing everyone's supposed to want, and he was the unhappiest person in the room. The guy with six lines was the happiest. The background actors were fine. They were just there for the sandwiches. But the lead was the cautionary tale.
Do you think he was always like that, or did the fame make him that way?
I don't know. I only saw him for one day. But I dated a woman once who did children's theater for 20 years. Never made more than $18,000 a year. She said it was the only thing that made her feel alive. She'd come home from a show, and she'd be glowing. Not because of the money. There was no money. Because she'd spent the afternoon being someone else for a room full of 8-year-olds. She said fame was the last thing she wanted. She just wanted to keep doing the work.
She probably wouldn't trade places with the miserable lead for anything.
She said exactly that once. I asked her if she'd want to be famous, and she said no, said she'd rather be good. I think about that a lot.
That's the distinction, isn't it? Famous versus good. The public assumes they're the same thing, but they're not. You can be famous without being good, and you can be good without ever being famous. And the research says the people who last are the ones who care about the good.
The fame is almost a distraction from the actual work, a tax on the craft. Some people can pay it and stay sane, like Matt Damon. Some people pay it and it breaks them, like the lead in Ilbert's story. And some people never pay it at all. And they're the ones doing children's theater for $18,000 a year and loving every minute.
The woman I dated, she said something else once. She said the audience doesn't know what you're doing. They just know if they felt something. And that's the whole job. Making them feel something. Everything else is noise.
That's a good note to sit with. The audience doesn't know what you're doing. They just know if they felt something. That's the craft, stripped of everything else.
That's what the research keeps finding. The people who do this for a living, the ones who stick with it through the rejection and the poverty and the instability, they're chasing that feeling. The moment of connection. The thing that happens when a room full of strangers feels something together. The fame is incidental. The craft is the point.
If you take one thing from this, it's that the fame lens is a historical accident, not a fundamental truth about acting. We've been living in a century-long anomaly where the industry manufactured celebrity as a business strategy, and we mistook that for the essence of the profession. But the essence was always the work, the transformation, the storytelling, the connection. The select few who pursue acting aren't chasing fame. They're answering a call, and the call was there long before the fame was.
Recognizing that changes how you see the whole profession. The struggling actor isn't a failed celebrity. They're a working artist in a system that only values the top fraction of a percent. The intrinsic motivation that keeps them going isn't naivete. It's the same thing that keeps surgeons and teachers and clergy going, a sense that this is what they're for.
The open question, I think, is what this says about other fields. If intrinsic motivation can sustain people through extreme outcome inequality in acting, what does that mean for how we structure careers in general? Are we over-relying on external rewards to motivate people, when the real driver is something internal? And what happens when we build systems that only recognize the external rewards?
That's a question for another episode, but it's the right one to leave on. The acting case suggests that the stories we tell ourselves about why people do what they do are often wrong. We assume fame seekers, and we find craftspeople. We assume ambition, and we find calling. And that gap between the assumption and the reality is worth paying attention to.
Thanks as always to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop, for keeping the show running.
This has been My Weird Prompts. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review. It helps other listeners find the show.
We'll be back soon.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head. Send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird props, that's the close from sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird props, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.